Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, your source for conservative talk on a Friday early evening. And do I have a heck of a show for you guys tonight? A couple of weeks ago, we had the vice president of the Libertarian Party, great guy. And we started talking about some legal aspects of judicial activism and you know, if the courts are doing them, how far they are. Well, none of us were lawyers, so I just kind of felt, and my original plan was, let's have a couple of legal heavyweights here. And tonight we got Ken W. Good, who I view as legal heavyweight. We've had him a couple times on a couple shows. He speaks quietly, firmly, and then you kind of look at yourself and you're like, man, he just educated. He just took me to the woodshed. You know, so he's one of those kinds, and I love those type of individuals because I'm the exact opposite. I'm all excited, and my emotions get the best of me. And then we have Randy Burholtz, and he is a Rhodes Scholar, former secretary of the California Republican Party. Don't look down on him for that. He did his best. And we are going to talk tonight on due process. What exactly is due process? And I want to talk about that because of the Abrego situation. I've gone back and forth with people in terms of due process. And what I've learned about due process is it's habeas corpus for illegals or something to that effect. And I'd like to get our legal scholars' legal take on exactly what that means or to correct me. And then we're going to talk about judge shopping. You hear that a lot, judge shopping. The Federalist had a phenomenal article on judge shopping, and I think the Gavin Newsom versus Trump with the National Guard is a great case of judge shopping. Then we're also going to talk about judicial activism. I believe there's no doubt that there is judicial activism. I mean, if they're judge shopping, they're shopping for judges that are going to be friendly to them. And we're going to talk about some cases regarding that I think really show judicial overreach. And then we're also going to go into Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, and what she said in one of the opinion pieces, and what she said about Ketanji Brown, she kind of slapped her down. And what I found ironic about that was that she was very unpopular with conservatives. My issue is always coming from a third world country, born an American citizen, but the courts to me are sacred ground. They are where the little man gets his day in court. So I do not like judicial activism. So when conservatives are down on Amy Coney Barrett, I'm like, well, what was the case? Because if she followed the Constitution, I'd like her to vote this way. But if she followed the Constitution, I can't argue about that. So we're going to talk about that. And I want to point out, we are going to talk about what I view as the granddaddy case of judicial activism, and that was Obamacare and the penalty versus a tax. And to those, I know it's in the news. I don't want to talk about it only because nobody knows anything, but I want to give these two individuals take on the Epstein case and what is happening with that. And with that, let us bring on our panel, and I will introduce them by name, and I will have them tell themselves a little bit, we'll have them talk a little bit about themselves in their own words, so you know who they are. And I view them as legal heavyweights, and I hope they back it up in their intro. Don't be shy, gentlemen. Well, we have Randy. I thought I saw Randy come in, but we have the G-Man here. G just came back from a vacation in Hawaii, and no, that is not a tan. That's just his natural handsome look there, you know. And everybody knows the G-Man. And then we have Mr. Ken W. Good. What I know about Ken is just what I researched. Very impressive. Has a few law offices. Owns a bail bond. Is that how you say bail bonds company?
Well, I represent bail bondsmen across the state of Texas.
Okay, and with that, tell the audience a little bit about yourself, and don't hold back. Pump yourself up, brother.
Well, I've been an attorney for over 30 years. I am also married to an attorney. My wife and I have two children. I specialize in bail law, criminal justice reform type of issues. I represent bondsmen across the state of Texas. I've written articles across the country on criminal justice reform, bail reform, what makes good bail reform. And I've argued cases before the Supreme Court of Texas, the Court of Criminal Appeals, because we have two high courts in Texas, and before the Fifth Circuit. I've been very blessed and very lucky on identifying important issues and then analyzing them and being successful in arguing them. What got me to write articles on these issues is I attended a hearing in Houston on one of the earliest cases, and I just thought the judge was going crazy. And I came out and set the alarm off for our industry and for criminal justice reform, law enforcement minded people. And I think history has proven me correct because the judge was ultimately reversed 7 or 8 or 9 times, and the Fifth Circuit ultimately ruled that that case should have never been filed in federal court. And you know, at a time, courts across the country were relying upon it.
Oh, is it special to, it's like, you know, I remember when I took my criminal justice class in college, you know, you got to go to court and watch courts and watch the lawyers. But then as you start moving up to the seriousness of these, you know, you go to we always hear about the Ninth Circuit, but you go to that level. Is there something special? Is that like I'm in the big leagues now? I mean, how do you view that?
I view it as very specialized because so few cases get to the Court of Appeals because, you know, I mean, my theory on if I can win it without going to court, if I can convince the other side to let me, you know, give in to me, then why do I need to go to court to win? I'm not a show pony. I want to win any way I can. If I have to go to court, then, that's my last option. And if I have to go on appeal, my theory is I've already lost because my client has to spend money to go up on appeal. That's money they're never going to get back usually. And so I've already lost the case.
Gotcha. I just always view those. I'm like, that just seems, that's a different level, you know?
When I was a very young attorney, I did a lot of appeals, and I had a case that we just got killed at the trial court. And this company came to me, and I was a young attorney, and I even looked younger, and they were like, what is your plan? I said, well, we're going to appeal to the Court of Appeals. The judgment's going to get cut in half, and we're going to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court's going to take it, and we're going to win the rest of it. Well, we went to the Court of Appeals. They cut the judgment in half, and then we went to the Supreme Court of Texas. They accepted it, and it was written up as, this is one of the most important cases that's going to be decided this term. And then my client filed bankruptcy.
Oh, the realities of life, you know. It's that's tough to hear. Well, we got a big show, and I apologize about that. When we went to get you on the show, you know, I wanted to make it clear, hey, it could be up to a 90-minute show only because I want to cover this stuff. I want the audience to understand the reality of it from a legal perspective, and I hope we can get that to them in layman terms. But let's start with the Epstein case. I didn't really prepare for the Epstein. I don't know if you saw my notes. I'm very anal when I prepare. But the Epstein case was a last-minute decision I made today. I'm like, oh, gosh, everybody's talking about it. And for those of you that may not know, there was a memo that was released to Axios, which is ironic because it's more – I don't want to say they're full-blown leftists or not, but they lean heavily left versus we have the Trump admin. We have Pam Bondi, Dan Bongino, Cashapito. They're all conservatives. So this was – I don't want to say leaked. It was given to them in the sense that there's nothing to see here. And that stems back from a few weeks ago when Cash Patel and Dan Bongino were on Fox and other outlets stating he didn't kill himself. And my take is, well, that's not relevant, you know, to the client list. And then over the last few days, we've discovered no one's really actually ever seen a client list. Nobody really actually has any evidence to show a conspiracy. And I'm not defending Jeffrey Epstein or that side. It just seems like this week we started to get into the details of the legalese of it. And the truth of the matter is people say, well, they're holding that. They're not showing it. And Pam Bondi kind of opened the door to this quagmire because she went on Fox in February. And she was talking a lot of stuff. She was literally saying without saying that I'm looking at the Epstein list. And they have backtracked on that. Now, before I turn it over to you guys, two things I want to know. Bill O'Reilly came out the other day. I think he's on News Nation now, the segment there. And he said he talked to Trump in March. And he stated Trump said they were talking about MLK, JFK, and Epstein files. And he said, yeah, man, there's some names on the Epstein list that had nothing to do with this. And if those names get out just because they had dinner or lunch with Epstein, their lives are destroyed. And then Alan Dershowitz in March as well said there is an Epstein list. But he clarified that today by saying, and I learned this watching Megyn Kelly, phenomenal podcast. People almost as good as mine, you know. But Alan Dershowitz responded to her about that, and he said it's not a client list he saw, but these were redacted names in court filings because he spent literally his life savings to clear his name. The only witness that is public that has come out is Virginia Giuffre. I mispronounced her name, but she's kind of been rest in peace to her. She passed away about a month ago, actually. And she was caught, I don't want to say lying, but she wasn't seen as a credible witness. And that's one reason why the prosecution didn't bring her, put her on the stand when they prosecuted Ghislaine Maxwell. But on her, they prosecuted her for trafficking girls specifically to Jeffrey Epstein. So people are saying, well, why is she in prison if there is no client list? Well, they got her for trafficking specifically to him. So before we get to Ken, G, what's your thought on all this? What did you learn in Hawaii about the Epstein file?
I think the whole brouhaha is all about, I mean, Bill O'Reilly has a point, right? So if there are names on it, the Epstein Island is not Ashley Madison, right? If your name was in the Ashley Madison database, okay, you were logged into that website looking for an affair, right? And if you don't know what Ashley Madison data breach is, just Google it. You'll find it. Going to Epstein's Island is not that. Just because you were there doesn't mean that you were getting it on with underage girls, right? So I get that point. But this is all about transparency, right? So now Pam Bondi is saying that there's no list. Like, wait, what does that mean? He doesn't have on his computer, he doesn't have a day timer. I mean, does anybody use a day timer anymore? He doesn't have an iPhone with the contact list on there that says, hey, here's my 1,000 contacts. And at least these are the people I communicate with regularly. And the text messages, I mean, that itself is a list. So it seems like they're hiding something, right? And if it is all about, okay, well, not everybody there is should be guilty by association. Okay, fine. Say that. But at least say we're going to put the list out there. There is a list. We're putting it out there. But we don't want everyone to be guilty by association. I mean, Netanyahu, maybe he visited. Who knows? But does that mean that he did anything with these underage women? So I get both sides of it. I think Dan Bongino and now Kash Patel are threatening to resign. Kash is only going to resign if Dan resigns. So basically, Trump has to make a choice. Is it Pam Bondi or Dan Bongino that I keep? But they're resigning over this whole thing about transparency, right? So maybe they're the ones peddling fringe or close to conspiracy theories. I don't know. But this is not a conspiracy theory. He has a list. Epstein has a list. The feds have it. And Pam Bondi's saying it doesn't exist. I mean, it just doesn't pass the smell test. And Dan Bongino running a radio show for however many years, 5-6 years. And he was saying, we got to get to the bottom of this. Now his credibility is on the line. And so Pam Bondi's threatening that. So I get both sides of the issue, but there has to be some middle ground that you can strike that says, okay, here's a list, but that doesn't mean all these people are guilty. We'll have a secondary list of people who actually probably are guilty. And I don't know how you figure out who did what there, unless you have camera footage or something.
Well, let me push back a little bit on that, only because we live in an internet era. It doesn't matter if they're completely innocent and they're on just the phone list. He had a wrong number call. You know, the internet's going to destroy that person. You know how it is. If there's a picture with somebody, hey, look, there's a picture with him. So he's a pedophile. Ken, what's your thought on this legal wise and just as a person watching it from afar?
I think this is all about trust in government. I mean, we've heard for so long, so many years, there was a list, and if it ever became public, and then we have either a misstatement or a misrepresentation. It's on my desk waiting for me to review, and now we're being told there isn't a list, but people are threatening to quit if, you know, certain things don't happen. And so it just plays into all the conspiracy theories. It plays right into the sweet spot that there's a cover up, that people are not telling the truth. And it seems like we're switching parties. The Democrats weren't telling the truth. Now the Republicans aren't telling the truth. And so the way it's been handled is atrocious, so that trust in government has been undermined even more on this issue. And it's an issue that I don't know how you gain the trust of the public. No matter what you do, half the public will not believe you. And it may switch depending on your answer. But this is one of those catch-22 things now, especially because of the way it's been handled by you know, Bondi and her minions.
I agree. It looks like we have Randy here. Randy is people. He's so ugly, we can't have his face on the camera. Yeah. Randy, can you hear us? Oh, boy. It looks like we don't have Randy yet. Mr. Producer, if you can work on that, that would be great. So, gentlemen, well, Ken, let's go back to you. How do you think government can regain trust?
You know, the number one way that government builds trust is by both sides saying, okay, we may disagree with the result, but we respect it. So, you know, you saw that back in Nixon, you know, when someone was on trial and Nixon commented on it, and they had a whole hearing, had to ask all the questions about whether they were going to change their mind or they were going to, and, you know, they made a movie about it. And one of the jurors was like, well, I never liked Nixon to begin with. But imagine we started that, and now it's commonplace that people, elected officials comment, and we've got other elected officials standing in front of the Supreme Court saying if they don't decide the right way, then we're going to come after justices. So the way you build trust in the judicial process or on any issue is both sides say we agree that it was fair. Both sides agree that it was transparent. But we live in this tabloid journalism period where one party on any issue cannot agree to that.
Exactly. So let me push you a little bit then. So if you were in Pam Bondi's shoes, looking at it from the legal perspective as well as the PR perspective, let's put it this way, not in her shoes, but if you were advising her, what would you say to her specifically to do?
Something she can't do. She should bring in the previous boss or person on this issue. And then she should stand by them, and they should both say, we've reviewed this, and this is what we have, and we will stand here and we'll answer every question you have until you're through answering questions. I mean, that was the one thing probably Clinton did really well, when he would stand up and lie to the public about, you know, one sex, but he would stand there and answer every question that the reporters had until they got tired of answering questions. So once you do that, you kind of build some, at least sympathy. On this issue, I mean, I would say that they've really made it even worse by the way they've handled it.
Exactly. That's how I viewed it. And I think it started with Pam Bondi. I truly believe in my heart, her as an instructor told me in the military once, he was being sarcastic, my head's so big with my ego so big, I can't fit it through the door. And I think that was Pam Bondi. After she got the gig, she saw the governorship, it was politics, the headlights, and she got ahead of herself. And it's kind of a fumble is the term I keep hearing. As Clinton would say, I did not have relations with that woman, you know?
Well, but you know, this is her opportunity to show us who she really is, because the way she handles this speaks better about the type of person she is than when she's, you know, rolling with the flow and winning all the time. When you're fighting adversity or you're addressing a mistake, that's when you're showing who you really are.
That's true. That's true. That when you're willing to stand up and take the shots, and for better or for worse, Trump does that every single day with media. And I think that's why he's so beloved. And a good example, and I love using the example, is when he had his mugshot. He was proud of that. And mm-hmm. he used that to get to the black community and some in the Latino community, because they felt they could relate to that. And that's a great point, Ken. So, gee, though, that said, if you were in Cash Patel's corner and Dan Bongino's corner, because they seem to be on the opposite spectrum here. To me, it looks like they want to make her the scapegoat. And they may be right. It's like, oh, you're saying this, you put us in a tough position. But I also believe they want to save their civilian jobs once they leave here. And Dan Bongino has a 5 million fan base on Rumble for his video. And I know that may sound crass for me to say that, but we live in that type of world. And that's how they were making their living prior. What would you tell those two guys? Would you say stick around, get together with your boss, Pam Bondi, and as Ken says, stand up to the fire and just start answering questions? Or is it a case where it doesn't matter what they say, MAGA out there that's angry. They just want a scalp. They want somebody scalp who they believe could be a child molester, because that's what it seems to me.
Yeah, I think the question comes down to, at least in the eyes of MAGA, who's more MAGA? Is it Dan Bongino and Cash Patel or Pam Bondi? I mean, I think before January, what was it, when he was sworn in, 21st, 20th, nobody knew who Pam Bondi was, at least the average person, right? But everyone, I would say most average MAGA persons knew who Dan Bongino was. And maybe Cash Patel was kind of like this vague figure, but now they know him a lot more. I think if they had to cast their lot with who's more MAGA, it would be those two guys. So I think if Trump has to come down to a decision of which of these two do I keep, Dan Bongino or Pam Bondi, he's going to choose, I think, Dan Bongino to please MAGA, although I think he has tighter ties with Pam Bondi.
Well, hold on, guys. You may not be aware. Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, is very close to Pam Bondi.
What I mean, right.
Yeah, so go ahead, Ken. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, I think that where Cash Patel and Bongino, whatever his name is, saying, I can't pronounce that sometimes, but I think where they're coming from is they think she's affecting their credibility.
Yes.
And that's probably goes right into what you've been saying about it goes back to their credibility when they go back into their private lives. But I think they see this as what this fumble by Bondi is a substantial attack on their credibility. And it is. It's an attack on all three of their credibilities. But they see that as attack to them personally. And they can't withstand that when they get back into their personal lives.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree. Okay.
I totally believe that as well. I don't think it's necessarily about the job, although, you know, they got to pay the bill somehow. But I think it is about their integrity and honor. And I believe those two guys were chosen to be there because they got to deal with the deep swamp, right? The deep state, the swamp, right? I'm mixing terms here, but they were tasked with getting in there and breaking it up. And they're having a hard time doing that because now Pam Bondi, I don't know what her motivations are. Is she becoming part of the swamp? I mean, I think that's a big question in MAGA's eyes. That's what I see on X.
It could be a sign of personality issues, too, in the office, you know, in the inner workings with them. I mean, it could be as simple as that.
Okay, guys.
Your question, just real quick, your question was, how do you get past this? Maybe you release the list, but say, we don't know that any of these people are guilty, and then you're going to have 1,000 people go, I did not have.
Look, they can't survive this, I don't think, without releasing something. If they have something, they have to release it.
Exactly.
Remember, Elon Musk came out and said Trump's on the list, and that's the reason. So now you've got this whole argument that Trump's not releasing it because he's trying to save his own ass. And so they have to release something.
I agree. So let's move on from this. Before we move on, both of your final thoughts, and nobody's going to hold you to it because nobody knows what the hell's going to happen. So, G, what do you think happens here at the end of the day?
I think.
It's okay if you don't know.
No, I don't know. It's really 50-50, but I think Dan Bongino and Cash Patel are going to walk next week.
Ken, your thoughts. What do you think happens here?
Well, the chief of staff, I think, being close to Bondi is important. But I think Trump also likes her a lot. I have no idea. This has erupted so suddenly and so quickly. And it could blow over just as quickly. It depends on how much of it's been is manufactured. You know, I discount so much of everything I see in the press because everything that's out there is trying to hurt Trump in either by the person saying it or whatever. So I would say it's too early to know. It's just happened too quickly. And Trump's not going to put up with it for very long. Because he does, I mean, his people always play nice, and this is not going nice.
So my take is, looking at how Trump reacted during that cabinet, he wants this to go away. So he's kind of siding with people may want to call it the swamp or whatever. He wants this to go away. Something happens in the news, some big blow up, Iran, whatever, it'll go away. This didn't even rank in the top 5 during the election. I think a lot of people specifically the social media influencers, have latched onto this. I look at it like this. This is a terrible situation, but I'd rather learn more about COVID because that impacted the nation. You know, there, to me, this doesn't rank. I don't want to diminish it because it's a, you know, child trafficking, all that, the potential. But I think on the scale of Trump, he wants this to go away. He's close with Susie Wiles. All we've heard from her is nothing but she walks on water in terms of how she's been able to handle this administration. I don't know if people realize this administration from this admin, from the first one, is like night and day in how they were, they're able to handle the crisis. And I think he loves Susie for that. That's where her impact is. She's close with Bondi. And as Ken, you said, I've never seen not one negative thing. The only thing I could think you could say negative about it is he tweeted a positive post the other day about Cash and Dan and not Pam. But that's about it. So I don't know what's going to happen. But if you put a gun to my head, I'd say he's going to go with what Susie says. And if Susie's tight with Pam, they're going to try to get this swept under the rug. And if Dan and Cash Patel go, they resign, fine. But what are they going to be, anti-MAGA? By resigning, they'll lose their own audience. So I don't think they're going to be a threat. So that's how I see this blowing over. So to the audience, I wanted to talk about this because it's in the news. But as you can tell, nobody knows what's going to happen. You can be angry. We get it. It's important. But until we get some hard evidence from either side, it's going to be one of those one of those conspiracy things that everybody can take a passionate side on. Okay, so let's move on. And this is the reason I asked Mr. Ken W. Gidd to come on. And we're going to talk some judicial activism here. The first thing, Ken, and G, chime in whenever you want, but is due process for illegals. We heard so many things. And Big John, our producer, I know you're a libertarian. Chime in via the chat if you have questions or privately or whatnot, because you may have. Ken, what is due process specifically for an illegal alien, or what they call an illegal immigrant? I call it legal alien.
Well, you know, there's a spectrum of due process that applies to illegal aliens. And you start with the lowest level of due process that they're entitled to is if they are caught within 2 years, within 200 yards of the border, and they don't express any basis for being here legally, they're not claiming asylum, they can be immediately removed. They're not claiming something. They're not even setting out a reason that you would even need to litigate. So they can be removed, and that's due process. But if they're claiming asylum, then they have a right to a hearing, or if they've been here longer than 2 years, they have a right to a hearing. And then that hearing would decide whether they can stay or whether it will end in a order of removal.
Okay, Ken, hold on. I apologize. I may interrupt a lot like this, but just to clarify for the audience, they tend to confuse a hearing with, well, they haven't had their day in court. What's the difference between those two? Or is it one and the same?
Well, that's the same thing. Having a hearing, having your day in court. If you're an asylum seeker, you get a day in court in front of an immigration judge. It's an administrative proceeding. So, I mean, the rules of evidence don't apply. You can talk about hearsay. You can talk about evidence that would probably not come in a court. So it's very informal. But, like, most people get a hearing set 3, 4, 5 years from now, and they never show up. And so the court just enters an order of removal. A lot of the people we're hearing in the news already have an order of removal. Either they went to the hearing and lost, or they didn't go to the hearing. And so that once that happens, the only due process or extra due process you're entitled to is upon when they're trying to deport you, you can file a habeas corpus like you mentioned. But the only thing you can raise is to say, that's not me. They got the wrong guy. But what, the longer you're here, the more due process you're entitled to. If you are a green card holder, they cannot remove you without filing a proceeding to take away your green card first. If you're a naturalized citizen, we've heard some stuff about that recently, they can only remove you after filing a petition alleging that you committed fraud in your application to become a naturalized citizen. They can't remove you for any other grounds. They can't take away your citizenship for any other grounds. You had to have committed fraud in obtaining it. And then if you're a citizen, you can't be deported because you're already home. So right. They cannot deport a citizen. We hear stuff in the news, oh, they're going to deport citizens. No, they're not. They're going to deport people who are naturalized only if they allegedly committed fraud in their application. And so everything we're hearing about due process dealing with illegal aliens is mostly false.
So what you're saying by saying false is that the Trump administration, like I said, it's a different Trump admin from the previous one. To me, it seems like he's literally following everything in the book because he knows if he doesn't, they will eat him up. It's one thing to lie, but if they catch him on the truth, he's sunk in his mind. So to me, they're following the law.
But where the lie is that these people have not received due process, they already have. If there's an order of removal, they've already received due process.
So Ken, so when they miss their hearing, it's like, well, you're just validating that you're acting like a criminal by not even going to your hearing. Am I wrong to think that, or am I being too harsh?
Well, you're probably being just a little bit too harsh, but you remember a lot of these people were taught or instructed at the border by some of these activist groups, claim asylum, they can't kick you out. And so these were not asylum seekers to begin with. They were just coming to the United States, probably brought in by gangs, being trafficked. And, you know, so they needed to go work so they could pay back for the money for getting them to the United States. And so they didn't have any intention of going to the hearing anyway. It was just a lie to get them to stay. And then they just slipped into the country and we lost track of them.
You know, it's funny you say that because my cousin, oh, God bless him. I love my family. I'm Panamanian Puerto Rican. I am the lightest person in my family. They call me Blanquito when I go to Panama because I stick out. My relatives will not allow me to go anywhere, you know, because of how light my skin is. But my cousin came here and I get a phone call, extremely panicked. You know, I'm not going to say what it was, but he got busted. In essence, I went through the legal process and I finally said, you're going to get out. And the court told me this too. They said, go back to, and I'm not going to say I'm from two countries. So in a sense, my culture is, so I'm not going to say which one. I don't want to get in trouble. But I said, you're just not going to ever come back. There's going to be something, you'll have an open case here, but that's how I'm told it's played. You go back to the country, you're just never going to be able to come back, or you'll have a warrant or something to that effect. So I guess I can see how the mentality of how to game the system works in various ways on that.
Think about all these different illegal aliens that get stopped and how they fit into the due process that we've talked about. So we talk about just someone who came into the country illegally, never had a hearing, they never even knew they were here. They've been here 5 years. So they get stopped or they get arrested for a crime. Well, they're here illegally. I mean, all they're entitled to is a hearing before an immigration judge. And do you have a grounds for being here? And you would be subject to removal immediately. And the fact that they've had a crime, been accused of a crime, is what brings it to the government's attention. Mm-hmm. What people don't realize is when you get arrested and you go to jail and someone poses a bond for your release, that's what authorizes your release from the jail. But if there's an ICE hold, well, then you get released and delivered to ICE, and then ICE takes you to an ICE center, gives you a hearing, and then deports you.
Right. And that's one reason we're having all these protests, I believe, is because – so, for example – and correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, how I see is what you said, Ken, but normally they would work with ICE – and hand him over to ICE, says, okay, he's a criminal, but they're letting him back out on the streets. And now Tom Homan and company, they're forced to go to the streets to arrest these people. And
And what we've learned is we have now a complete reason for why they're doing all this. By encouraging all the illegal aliens to go to California and go to New York when there's a census, we count the people in a state based upon numbers, whether they're citizens or not, and we base the division in the House on their gross population, not citizen population. And so there's now some estimates coming out that between New York and California, they have 10 extra people in the House that they would not otherwise have had. So they're encouraging it for a reason. They're getting more power in Washington, D.C. as a result of what they're doing.
Correct. That's something G and I don't think we've ever done a formal show on it, but we're both in the San Diego area and we are well aware of that. That's why in the first Trump administration, I told people, you don't realize how crucial this court battle is where we lost and they were forced to count them in the census and they should not be counted. And it's just a whole plethora of issues. I don't know if you're aware, Ken, but the downfall of California exponentially started with Prop 187 in the 90s, and Prop 187 was passed by the people and it was a proposition that would not allow illegal aliens to have government services like welfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all I remember that.
And then you were deemed racist. And I was here. I was still fairly new to California. I was like, this is the beginning of the downfall. This is going to attract all these illegals. And then later on, I learned about the census and I thought we were really screwed. But what I find ironic is, well, the people passed it. But now, even the ones who fought against it back in the 90s overwhelmingly would support that bill now because we are so in debt, the cost of living. And we lost a couple of congressional seats on the last census despite all the illegals because of the outflux of the middle class taxpaying base that has fled. So very good point. Gee, any questions or any thoughts?
I do have a question in terms of those seeking asylum, right? So they come across the border. They say, I'm declaring that I'm seeking asylum. Two questions. One, that hearing takes place at some later time, right? So
yes,
that's the catch and release on this side of the border. But two, do you have to be from a particular country in order to claim asylum? And do you need to prove that you're from that country if that's the case?
Oh, I think the proving that you're from that country is a good point, but I don't know the answer to that. But you just have to come to a port of entry, or you just have to come into the country and claim asylum. Say, I'm here, I'm in fear. But Holman made a very good point about that. He said that if they put you in an ICE facility, the hearing has to take place within 30, 60 days. If they don't put you in an ICE facility, then that's the reason why the hearing can take place 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years later. And he was arguing that's the reason why they were putting people up in New York in hotels and paying double or triple what they would have had to pay in an ICE facility, because if they put them in ICE, they'd be processed in 30, 60 days, but otherwise it can take years. And that was a political decision by the, you know, far left.
The Biden, you know, that's a good point, Ken. I appreciate you saying that because to the audience, we look at things in black and white. We live in such a tribalistic world. We don't want to understand the nuance, and we view government as this behemoth that runs certain ways. But just like human nature, there are certain decisions they make because of the nuance of what they can get away with and what they can't. And that's a great point. They were putting them in the hotels because they wouldn't have that hearing. All right. So any final thoughts, gentlemen, either you on the due process, Ken, let the audience know, or G, any thoughts?
I would say everything we hear on the press about the illegal aliens not getting due process is a lie. I mean, it's just that simple.
Oh, hold on. I do have a question for you, Ken. Nothing legal specifically, but what's your thoughts when you hear about 300,000 kids, they don't know where they're at? I mean, when you hear that, both maybe from a legal perspective or just from a human perspective, what goes through your mind? And then you
I get really mad because we didn't hear one iota about that during the last administration when those kids went missing. In fact, you were belittled if you even thought about bringing it up. I mean, probably weren't, you know, it's not that bad. But suddenly, I mean, it's always a problem. The whole cage issue that that Obama did was an issue when a Republican was in office, even though it was taking place during a Democrat administration. So it's very upsetting. I mean, from a human nature, I mean, it makes this point. We're setting up policies to tie the hands of judges with good intentions, maybe to protect certain people. But when we do that, we tie the hands of judges so they can't address drug traffickers, organized crime, gangs, or career criminals. I mean, so even if it's with a good intent, the unintended consequences of it are 300,000 children. We don't know where they are.
Exactly. And that's not even talking about the women and kids that are raped and abused on their way up. So, again, the nuance of human nature and how we act towards one another, we're in denial. And what gets me about that is, where's your compassion? I'm like, where's your compassion? These kids are, they're being sex trafficked. These women are being raped. It's like that Home Depot. Part of the reason it was raided here in California that started the LA protests is because some of those illegals there had ties to the cartel. And maybe they didn't want to work for the cartel, but the cartel helped them up and get over the border, and now the cartel owns them. So there's so much.
But we are a welcoming nation. We have you have the correct way to come into the country, and we welcome you with open arms. When did we become a country that we have to welcome with open arms people that come to our country illegally?
Oh, that's easy. Yeah. When political entities realized there was power down the road with these people.
Sure. And then now it's like, well, at the same time, now we're welcoming with open arms drug dealers, drug traffickers. And you can't say anything against that. You're just a racist if you do.
You know, Ken, that's one reason I got into politics was because I'm Latino. And I'm like, no, you're not going to play that card on me. And that's when they really get upset because they can't throw the racist card at you. Go ahead, G.
Yeah, one thing I heard, and I'm not going to say who I heard it from, but it was an elected official here spoke to a group last month. She said that there are more slaves today than in 1860. And that's because of all these – I mean, the population's bigger, right? Mm-hmm. But the number of actual African-American slaves in 1860, the actual number – is less than the sexual slavery, the labor slavery that we have now because of these cartels bringing people over, and they're making money off of them too. So it is a human rights issue, not
look
for
at what
letting
ICE
them
did.
In, but why they're being let in and what's happening to them.
Look at what ICE did just in the last couple of days, raiding a weed farm, and you know, L.A. mayor came out and had a big press conference saying this is these poor people who are working on these farms, and they found so many children.
Yes,
I mean,
14
children that were there. So they, you know, they got some of this 300,000 children and found them. And the mayor of L.A. is having a press conference bemoaning that they found underage children working illegally at this facility. And it's, I mean, yeah.
They're not
the
sitting
Democrats
in the state of a tree playing their Nintendo Switch. They're
but the Democrats are stepping into a trap set by Trump.
You know,
the midterm election is going to be about illegal aliens, and that plays 80-20 right into the Republicans' hands.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So we got Miss, how do we put this? Miss Doreen Georgopoulos saying, the U.S. is not a welcoming country to immigrants anymore. And I would disagree. We are extremely welcoming. My mother's a naturalized citizen. We got relatives coming from Panama. They're all following the legal process. Now,
my daughter is dating someone who moved here when they were 10, came from a foreign country. They had a sponsor. They followed the legal process.
Exactly.
And he's a naturalized citizen.
Exactly.
And I'm a naturalized citizen myself.
Yeah.
I like you.
Ken's our Indian representative. Hey. I'm the Latino. You're the minority here, Ken.
Yeah.
But no, we are welcoming to Doreen, and I'm sure it's happening in New York City, in Springfield, Ohio, in California, throughout the state. The social services are overwhelmed, and these states are bankrupt. That's why, even as a Californian, I was against the SALT cap, which gave us a $40,000 deductible. Why? Because the politicians here are going to keep raising taxes because we can recoup some of that because the rest of the country is going to have to foot the bill. But if we didn't have that, our taxes would go up, and we would immediately be going to our state legislature and go, what the hell? And that's not happening. So we are a welcoming nation. And if we weren't, why are all these immigrants wanting to get here? Go to one of the greatest experiences I have every time I go to any urban city is the taxi cab. It's usually a hardworking minority of sorts coming over here. And I remember going to New York City. Our office was in Times Square. Bad investment move for the company. I came in like 6-7 times. 4 or 5 of those times, they were African immigrants. And man, the stories, the hope, and they were working their tails off so their kids could have a better life. And, you know, so it's a chain effect. So we are extremely welcoming. And most people who do it legally, that's why legal immigrants are the ones who are fighting the hardest against a lot of this illegal immigrants we see.
Well, and the comments has a comment about the time and the money spent, the amount of money that people are spending on cartels. to get them to this country, and that they have to work to pay back once they get here is going to far outweigh that. And they're going to be slaves when they get here. If you look at the arguments that's trying to defend illegal immigration, I mean, you could argue it's the same arguments the South used in the right before the Civil War to try to defend slavery. Please, we need our cheap labor for our weed farm. Oh, please, we need
you're right. That's my biggest pet peeve.
Cotton, but now it's who will pick the vegetables.
Exactly.
The same
That's
argument.
My, yeah, see that, especially with Jasmine Crockett. I'm like, coming from a black woman who is strong, has a position of power, who forgets what her people did, but easily throws those tropes onto us Latinos, because back in the day, it was black people with cotton. But now she's promoting who's going to pick our strawberries, our weed. It's like Bishop Boudet, the Episcopalian bishop that chastised J.D. Vance and Trump at their first time they went to church after they got elected. Trump got reelected. She actually said, who's going to clean our toilets? Who's going to scrub our toilets? Who's going to, you know, everything is like, what irks me is, I'm going on a rant here and I apologize, but what irks me is, we're going to make your job $30 an hour to flip a burger so you can have a job to support your family, have a career. I'm like, flipping burgers is not a career. So how about, that's a minimum wage job. Let's go learn some English, go to school, and work your way up the ladder. It's like, they're you looking at us Latinos as stupid, ignorant apes who are only good to scrub toilets, pick fields, wipe babies' butts, and work in the hotel service industry.
That's right. And they're trying to reconcile two contradictory arguments, right? So it's the Democrat and the far left that make the argument that minimum wage needs to be higher, needs to be, quote-unquote, a living wage. Yet, every time that happens, the cost of living jumps up by a significant amount. So then they sit there and go, well, how are we going to have cheap vegetables? And how are you going to have a clean toilet unless you bring these people who don't work for minimum wage, but work for far less than minimum wage. And it's got to be the Latinos because they live right there and they're willing to clean your toilet for cheap. So that's the problem with their argument, is they're realizing, wait, every time we bring the minimum wage up, everything gets more expensive and the poor become poorer.
Yep, that's true.
Well, it's also partly identity politics. When you hear Craddock talking about like that, it's just identity politics. It's, you know, we are discriminating against illegal aliens like we have historically against blacks, like we've done these other things. So it's a play to identity politics. And I think Trump, too, has burst that bubble. And if the Democrats are going to play on the identity politics going forward, they're going to lose. Because the public's had enough of this, and only their hardcore left is still stuck on the identity politics. And the problem with that is they've created a mob, and the problem is when you create a mob, you lose control over the mob. And so Jasmine, what she's doing is trying to still steer the mob, and they can't do that anymore. I mean, that small group that's left is so rabid. You know, they're having town halls where they're telling their elected officials, you're not doing enough and you need to even do illegal acts and you need to be violent to represent our views. That's going to fall apart and be rejected by the country very quickly. And I don't even think it can win an election. So, I mean, the big test is going to be the mayor for New York in a few months. So that'll be the big test. I think it may just be the final straw to break the back of the Democrat Party.
It could be. And I left this question up. The reason you know this is because they'd rather risk their lives than spend 15 and 10 years. And I can tell you there's a twofold answer, because I know a lot of people who have come in just being Latino, living in, and not even, you know, Panamanians, Puerto Ricans, but various countries. And they are the most appreciative people because they put their life savings on the line and they're going to make it back in their mind. They see the American dream and they pursue it. Some of our greatest inventions, some of our greatest success stories are from immigrants who came here legally. But I'll say this.
But they're religious and they're going to be conservative. Yes. That's what they're finding.
Exactly. And every Latino has known that from day one. It's just the media spins a different tale. But that said, I do think we need to look at how we're doing legal immigration and figure out how to streamline it if possible. But right now, if somebody said, William, what do you think if we need just stop immigration right now? I'm like, get everybody in who's already been in line, but I'm okay with that because we are overwhelmed with, I mean, people who sit there, my partner, Big John, a good friend, I mean, he's always complaining about $37 trillion in debt. Well, our social services are overwhelmed, brother, and that debt's just going to keep going up. But it's only 1%. You got to start somewhere to cut it and get going. So, Ken, this is why I said 90 minutes. We always get sidetracked here, and I apologize. So let's get back on track here, people, And let's move on to judge shopping. Let's talk. First of all, Ken, I presented to you the Newsom versus Trump with the National Guard because my first thought, hey, this is L.A. Isn't there a closer court or a D.C. court because it's a D.C. Government order or whatever the term is. But yet they go to a judge in San Francisco who is an uber leftist. I mean, am I wrong in how I'm looking at it? Or is it just shopping? Is that just a myth? Your thoughts on it. Educate us on that.
Well, in the Newsom versus Trump case, I would say that this is the biggest colossal mistake ever made by a governor. But from a political standpoint, since he was trying to do his little podcast and appear to be a centrist when his party will not allow a centrist to get the nomination, it was a 100% correct political move to retreat and become one of the good old left-wing boys again. And he's probably cemented himself, but for the rest of the country, he made a fool of himself. I mean, here's a guy who before he was through celebrating his victory from, you know, the judge who, Judge Breyer, the Ninth Circuit, the most liberal circuit in the United States, issued a stay. And then they issued an opinion saying, you know, Trump is most likely going to win this and, you know, y'all were stupid. I mean, that's pretty much how you could summarize that. And the judge comes across as partisan. And I would say when you're judge shopping, it's all about Trump has 1,461 days for his fourth term, and judge shopping is about delay. If we can delay what he wants to do one more day, then we only have 1,460 days left. Right. And so when you're seeing a lot of these opinions, it's mostly about delay.
Right. Right. I found it ironic, too, because you're right. He was celebrating, had on social media, had already talked about it. And it was literally minutes later. It's like Trump is back in control. I mean, that was a big bruising. But look.
Let me make one other point. We keep hearing Trump is a threat to democracy. All of these things, and especially the actions of Newsom, show that Trump is not a threat to democracy. He's a threat to the Democrats. I mean, if the court had made that ruling and it had been upheld, no federal president would ever be able to call out the National Guard without the consent of a governor. It would become ultra politicized, and that would have been a bad ruling for the country. It would have been a good ruling for the Democrats, but a bad ruling for the country. So I would say Trump is not a threat to democracy. He's a threat to the Democrats, and we need threats to the Democrats right now.
You know, it's ironic because this is a classic case of how quickly we forget history, because people don't know the two times the president ordered the National Guard into service was against the governors. The governors say, no, we do not want the National Guard. And what were they for? The Selma March, which is historical now, and allowing African-American kids to go to high school. So it's like they don't care. It's about winning, and it's about lying. Look, I'll be the first to tell you, Trump is it's about Trump. You know, Trump has his ego, et cetera, et cetera. But I truly believe, I've come to realize, I think he really loves the country, and he is following the law because he understands the power. See, we may sit there and say the media is no more, they've lost their power. They still wield a lot of power in getting their narratives across, even though nobody's watching them. That in and of itself is a massive win for them, that despite the fact they have some of the lowest viewership, they can still shape the message. And as a Panamanian who lived under the Noriega, that's, as a kid, I realized he who controls communication literally controls that land. You know, so, G, any questions here for Mr. Good regarding this, or any thoughts on this?
No, not right now.
Okay, so let us move over to the judicial activism. Our good friend, that we had on a couple of weeks ago said that he didn't think it was judicial activists, that they were just countering the overreach of the executive branch. Now, I'm not going to argue overreach because the president has gained more power over the last 40 years because Congress does not want to make hard decisions, for example, on immigration. They care more. To me, if this is a simple black and white logical thought process, they want to get elected. They don't want to make any decisions whether sending somebody off to an unnamed war legally or dealing with immigration. They care more about getting re-election, so they're okay with the president doing some of these things. And I think over the decades, over the last three or four generations, the president has gained more power. I think some of these decisions give the presidency maybe more power than they should have. I mean, I'm not saying it does, but I can see the argument for that. But it's not the court's job. The court's job is to interpret the Constitution and the laws in the books. It's not to be activists and change laws or create decisions that are considered overreach. That is Congress's job. Before we go into the judicial activism, we'll start with G, then Ken. Am I looking at it wrong? I mean, am I wrong in my thought process that the executive has gained more power, but that's because we have an impotent Congress that's willing to be that way? G.
Yeah, I mean, think about all these departments that we have that are under the president's purview, and then they're just given this budget, right? So we know here in California, every July 1st, the gas tax automatically goes up so that the legislators don't have to be held accountable. They can say, I never voted for that. That was 2017, whoever was in the legislature at the time, at that time. So it's a similar thing. Like you said, now these guys don't have to be accountable. So I think putting the Department of Education on notice that we're going to disband you, I think that's a good thing because it needs to be held accountable to the people, and that's done through our House of Representatives. So I agree with you on that point, absolutely.
Ken, your thoughts on that?
You know what? I think we can't compare apples, Republicans and Democrats on this issue because during Biden's administration, early on, he was saying, I can't do this because this is something Congress has to do. And then when it came close to an election and it looks like they needed a jolt, then all of a sudden, oh, I'm going to do it anyway because Congress won't act. Well, he just got through saying that he didn't have the power to do it for a couple of years. And so Republican groups would file suit and a judge would say he couldn't do it and then it would go up. I would even argue that's what happened. I mean, we didn't have the argument they couldn't do it, but I think that's to some extent what happened on Obamacare. But I think what's happening with Trump is not that. I mean, I think Trump is outworking the Democrats, first of all. I mean, he has been proven to only need 5 hours sleep or less a night. He's done that for many, many years. The amount of work that he puts in, the executive orders that he's passed in the last, in his first 3 months, probably rivaled executive orders that have been passed by entire terms. So, but I do agree with what you're saying about what the courts are supposed to do is say, does this violate the Constitution? Not does it violate my political views. And I think a lot of these decisions that have been handed down are the executive order violates my political views. And it was all orchestrated, in my opinion, respectfully, because they were started out by handing down TROs. And from an appellate perspective, TROs are not appealable.
For the audience, TRO is a temporary restraining order?
A temporary restraining order, but that cannot be appealed. So they were doing a lot of this from a temporary restraining order perspective to get a quick headline that Trump was violating the Constitution. And then the courts of appeals caught on. And so they started converting the TROs to preliminary injunctions, which are appealable, and then staying them. And then you see, we just had one in the last week where they passed the big, beautiful bill and one judge in Boston said, is staying that, and with no reasoning. And everybody has just absolutely attacked her. And I'm like, I think again, it was planned. She put no reasoning into her order to make it very clear it's a TRO. It can't be converted to a preliminary injunction. Violate the federal rules of civil procedure, but it can't be converted or reversed.
Okay, so Ken, I apologize. You're going to have to dumb that down for us. So in essence, when you're talking to somebody who is not a lawyer, working class Joes like us, how would you sit there and say, William, this is why it's judicial overreach?
It's judicial overreach because they're not measuring with it's judicial overreach because the Constitution sets the floor of what the court, sets the ceiling on what the president can do. As long as he's within, under that ceiling, what he's doing is proper. What these judges are ruling is they disagree with the policy, and that's not their job. The policy is set by the president. They're only determining whether it violates the ceiling of the Constitution. And
exactly.
That's not what they're ruling.
Gotcha. See, that's what I always try to say. That's what I mean by their job is to look at the Constitution. Is the executive branch violating the Constitution? And to me, the media is spinning it as if he is just because the judge, you know, stays the order or does whatever legal action.
Well, and the judges are trying to put it in that tone, but when it gets to the Court of Appeals, then they're completely taking what their analysis is and tearing it up and throwing it away because it's not a proper analysis.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's get to what I call the granddaddy, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that is 2012 Obamacare, the penalty to where you're going to have to pay it. You get a penalty if you don't have health care. And through the whole campaign, meaning as it worked its way up the courts, the Obama regime, that's what I call them, a regime, they kept saying it's a penalty. It's not a tax. And I can't remember why they kept saying that, but it was clear as
because
day.
Because Obama's running for re-election.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, because it's a penalty. It's not a tax. And then Justice Roberts came out, and to me, in layman terms, he changed it from a penalty to a tax to sit there and give it validation to make it legal. And I thought that was complete politics, and that is not the role of the judicial system. The reason I thought that was going to back to the court thing, I was in court. It was a DUI. It was the defendant said my client was nowhere near there. The cop had done, he had accident. It was a New Year's ticket. You know, the cop had accidentally put the previous year, not the current year. And the cop tried to explain that. And I can't remember what the judge said, but the judge said it was like, well, I don't care. The ticket says this day. This man was nowhere near there. On that day, he gets off. And I was like, you know, I was young. I'm thinking, okay, common sense. But the judge was following the law. So when I saw that SCOTUS decision, that's what the first thing that came to my mind. They presented it as a tax. It was his job to rule it. I'm sorry, he presented it as a penalty. It was the SCOTUS' job to rule that from the penalty perspective. So I view that as clear activist judges in that. Am I wrong in looking at it that way?
No, I think you're right. And I would even say it's worse than that because let's compare. Statements made by Trump have been used in court decisions where he's, you know, his first term he was pretending to be a politician and doing a terrible job about it and misspeaking a lot. And then now he's acting like a businessman who's coming in and taking over a bankrupt company, and that's exactly what he knows what to do or knows how to do. So I think – so he made comments about things and they were used against him in court proceedings. And this case is an example of the opposite happening. Obama's made comments that were detrimental in the lawsuit and the court did not use them against him. But I would also highlight, I'm surprised this case hasn't gone back to the Supreme Court because the decision is all over the place. I mean, there's a plurality of judges and there's concurrences and there's part of the decision that has a 5-vote support, but there's other parts that don't. And so I'm actually shocked that this issue hasn't gone back. And I would say the reason why it hasn't is because I've always heard, just like you said, Roberts is the key and he's going to do whatever he can to uphold the health care. Not because it's Obamacare, because it's healthcare. And I read an article a long time ago that it was because of something that happened with his mother. And so I think he doesn't see it clearly. It's not a constitutional issue to him. So it's judicial activism because for him, he wants this result. He's not analyzing the Constitution on this issue, in my opinion.
And for me, I'm going to, for the audience, one reason why us, I'm not an immigrant. I was born an American citizen. My dad's Puerto Rican, so technically it's a U.S. territory. And my mom came back from Panama, or came up from Panama, became a naturalized citizen. So I kind of am not one, but I kind of view myself as part of that family. And the reason I want to bring this up is in Panama, the politicians were bought off. The state legislature were bought off. And in most of these countries, you always see the judges who try to uphold the law. They get murdered. They get rooted out. You know, that's the last bastion of hope. So for me to see the courts acting this way, it's depressing. It truly
is. But you know, we're already there. Kavanaugh has had somebody try to kill him. So,
And they gave him no protection. That's what blew my mind. These Supreme Court justices, and in my heart, and I have no proof, but they purposely did not give him protection. The Democrats have antagonized this. I said this before. Don't give me this. I hate it when a politician, a Republican, goes, "We must tone it down." I'm like, "We? There is no we. It's Democrats that
are being
divided." We've
got lots of examples of the now. Exactly. Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court, Kennedy, when he was running as a Democrat, they wouldn't give him protection. And then Trump, they wouldn't give them the resources they needed until suddenly someone's shooting at him. And, you know, there's been six of the Secret Service detail that have now been suspended as a result of that.
Exactly. And to the audience, we just completed our first draft of our first true crime podcast, and that is a Trump assassination attempt. So look for that here in the next month or two. Okay, G, any questions in terms of or comments on the affordable health care penalty versus tax or anything for Ken?
No, I mean, I think, you know, looking back at that, I remember waking up that morning thinking it was going to be struck down. I just knew forcing people to buy something, and you're forcing all of America to buy something, it's an obvious slam dunk. And then when Roberts came out saying, no, this is a tax, wink, wink, nod, Obama, you get your win, you get reelected in 6 months, it's a tax, right? Yeah, it's a tax,
But that decision did strike down the expansion of Medicaid. And so there was, I mean, it was a split decision. I think it was worse than a split decision, but I agree. I mean, I think that's a good example from maybe the conservative side or at the Supreme Court of judicial activism. And, you know, how many judges were on the bench then that are no longer there? There's at least four, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, the result would be completely different if that issue went to the Supreme Court now. I know there was an Obamacare issue at the Supreme Court on the last week, but I think if that case was repeated today, it would be a different result. Because it would be probably 5-4 because Roberts would be in the minority.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's gone back up in any form or fashion. And for the audience, what I mean is, like, there were various types of cases before Roe versus Wade was overturned. So sometimes you need that right case. And I don't think they're even bothering to look for it because it's kind of set in. It's kind of become the norm. And the health insurance.
Well, but they want it to be a political issue, not a judicial issue. I mean, Roberts would say that's the politicians need to decide that, not the courts.
Right. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. So, Ken, are you familiar with the Justice? I'm assuming you are, but I don't know if you're familiar with the Justice Amy Coney Barrett, what she wrote and how she slapped down Ketanji Brown Jackson, a.k.a. I don't know what a woman is, Supreme Court Justice. Can you explain to that why she was slapped down so harshly? Because right now, her reputation is coming about as somebody who goes that's more ideological. And she was at a conference just this week, pretty much in essence said it's about what she feels, what she thinks should be done versus the law. And it seems like Amy Coney Barrett kind of slapped her down in that. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why that's kind of important for us to understand?
Well, there was a decision that was handed down the last week, and, you know, the last week in June is where all the most contentious, most controversial, most important decisions from the Supreme Court of the United States are handed down, the last Friday in June. And that decision was dealing with birthright citizenship, except birthright citizenship wasn't the issue. It was nationwide injunctions where all these judges were saying, oh, we disagree with you, and we're going to issue a nationwide injunction to prevent you from enforcing your executive order. And they struck down that. I mean, you could do a beautiful analysis of the history of justice, judges or justice from the Supreme Court talking against that. But we don't need to go into that. I mean, only the law nerds like me would really.
Oh, but
that.
It's important, Ken, because Sotomayor talked about how that was a bad deal a few years ago. And then she voted to keep the injunction.
Yes, Sotomayor.
Ideology.
Yes, absolutely. She did. She was at a conference talking about we can't have a nationwide injunctions. And then here she is dissenting from it. But what's important is, this is not Barrett versus Jackson. Barrett wrote the majority opinion that had 6 votes for it. And so 6 justices. And I'm just telling you, at the Court of Appeals level, for me to go to you and say, with respect, we disagree with your analysis, that's pretty harsh at the appellate level. Well, this was way past that. These 6 judges have had enough of Jackson. They're like, your analysis is not analysis. We're not going to spend any time with it because it is so stupid. 6 justices of the Supreme Court are telling Justice Jackson that her analysis isn't even worth their time because it doesn't even cite any authorities and it's just political rhetoric. And then the point was Jackson signed on to the dissent that was written by one of the other of the 3 liberal judges. So she signed on to that. So the legal analysis was against it was done by a different judge. Then she decides to do this opinion that it's only her single dissenting opinion, where she essentially attacks the majority from a political standpoint and cites no authority. And the interesting thing says since then, the Supreme Court has issued a per curiam opinion granting a stay on another issue. And Kagan wrote a concurring opinion on that because Jackson dissented again. And even Kagan attacked her analysis very respectfully. So we now have 7 of the 9 justices of the Supreme Court telling Justice Jackson, essentially, you're stupid. Your analysis is not analysis. I mean, I remember one of the justices was asked by a president, who do you think I should be nominating to the Supreme Court? And he didn't say liberal, conservative. He said, just give us smart people. And I think we just have 7 of the justices of the Supreme Court of the United States saying Jackson's not a smart person.
And she's probably, I don't know, but I'm assuming she's probably one of the youngest. So she's there for a while.
Yeah, but she can be in the minority and ostracized by the whole court, even the liberals.
Was she in that decision, was she professing for more, like it's okay for our judges to be even more activists or activists as they currently are? Is that what she was saying?
Yeah, they have to. Yes. I mean, it was all political. We have to be a governor of, a governor when I mean, keep you from going on a certain speed, not governor of a state, but a governor that regulates your speed. So to slow down. So she was advocating for the delay. Let's stop Trump. I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with whether it's constitutional. We just don't like Trump.
Yeah, that was one of those as a sailor. Ram! Yeah, those cat fights there. Gee, any comments?
Hurt her reputation for years and years to come. I mean, she may be the youngest person on the court, but, I mean, you can't withstand. I mean, is she going to stand up to people calling her dumb for the next 30 years?
That's just it. She. Now, this is not me saying this. This is Joe Biden. She is a DEI hire. Joe Biden himself said, he said it proudly, she's a DEI hire. Her qualifications were to be a woman and black, which makes it ironic. The 2 qualifications Joe Biden said he was going to look for was a woman and black. And then when they ask her, what is a woman? I don't know. it's like you got nominated because you're a woman. I mean, as a working class guy, that's what drives me up a wall.
Yeah, but she knows what a woman is. She just can't say that because of where she is on the politics.
Oh, exactly. Right. No, exactly. I agree. But see, that's what to me makes it worse is you are a justice is supposed to be above that. I don't view myself as a minority per se because of my skin tone. And I've had relatives tell me, hey, you're not like us in a way, but never in a negative way. It's one of my relatives said, you're the lucky one, but you just got to keep your eyes out and take care and make sure we don't get screwed over. They weren't saying it a bad way. They were saying the responsibility. But when I look at a justice and I look at Jackson as being black, and then I look at Clarence Thomas, I go, you've got the weight of your culture because of the way we've structured our world, our nation, for good or bad. And I think Clarence Thomas has represented that to the best of what an American is supposed to be and what the justices are supposed to represent. And I look at Jackson as, you are on the complete other spectrum, and you are going to continually divide us tribalistically because of your ideology. And that kind of bugs the hell out of me.
You know, I don't know how to respond to those arguments, because to me, those types of arguments are intended to cut off debate. It's language that's very incendiary, and it's intended so we don't have to respond to you on the merits. I mean, I always say, if you can't respond to me on the merits, you're just going to call me a racist. But I mean, I grew up very poor. My grandfather was a sharecropper. And so, I mean, my parents were the first ones in their families to go to college. I was the first one to ever go to law school. And I had one suit to go interview with. I had one suit for my internship. And so, I mean, I couldn't afford anything. I was there on student loans and worked my ass off to get the success I had. And I've never looked at skin color. I want to be with the smart people. I don't care what color your skin is. I don't care whether you're a man or a woman. But if you're in law school and you're smart, I want to study with you. And I want to work with you. I mean, I don't want to be with somebody who is not the brightest person on the team. I've always been the problem solver on the trial team. So if you couldn't figure out how to get something into evidence, you came to me. If you screwed something up, you came to me to get it fixed. I mean, those are the type of people I want to work with. And I don't care what color of skin they are. I don't care whether they're men or women. I want to work with the brightest. And I want to live in a community where we give everyone the ability that I was able to do, coming from a very poor background, lift myself up and then run with it. And my concern is, when we have some of these issues, they become almost entitlement. I don't need to work because I check some boxes, and I will rest on that. And that's not people I want to work with.
Yeah, and that's what makes the illegal versus the legal immigrant so different. And it's not that the illegal doesn't want to work. It's the Democrats that you're going to get this free. And by human nature, once you start to get something free, giving it up is tough.
But it destroys companies. Look at Budweiser and their DEI advertising. I mean, look at was it Jaguar that tried the
Jaguar.
And yeah, they have destroyed both brands. And so that type of hiring destroys companies, destroys countries. Mm-hmm. So why would we ever – I mean, we want the brightest. We want to give everybody the opportunity to become the brightest, but we want the brightest, no matter what color or race or sex they are.
And before we move on to our last topic, I'll have the last word on this subject, is I felt alone, even though I have my skin tone as a Latino who was conservative. And the one positive that I learned from the internet is like, oh, there's millions of us out there, you know? And Ken, I feel that at times, and the best word I can think of is, the Democrats have done a good job of castrating the Anglo. And I've told my friends who are Latinos, who are conservatives, we've got to pick up the slack, because a lot of times the Anglo is just scared. And we saw the cancellation. We see that happen. So sometimes we got your back, brother.
Well, I've been in a case before where they can't respond to my arguments, so they just say you're a racist.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just intended to cut off debate. And it also plays right into the identity politics.
Exactly.
Stop listening to Ken, because he's not the same skin color as you and me. So stop listening and disregard the fact that I cannot respond to his arguments.
Exactly.
Just take it for granted that I should win.
Exactly. Oh, and the final comment I'll give before we get to Elon Musk and the third party is, it'll never happen. I'll never push for it, but I wish we had forced military service, because in the military, it's rank, and you're day one, you're working with Asians, with blacks, with Filipinos, all kinds, and you're forced. And there's still homophily, where in the birthing or your friends, they tend to be the same culture, but you work together, you get along. And I've seen so many long lasting lasting friendships, so I'll never push that. But military neighborhoods are some of the most diverse. My pack that I ran with as a kid, there was two whites, two Asians, a couple of Lumbee Indians, a black guy, and I was a Latino. And I didn't realize growing up, I will never see that type of diversity outside of a military town again. So I really do wish we could do force, you know, like the Israelis do. You got to join the military. Not because I want us to go die in war. It's, you don't, that brings people together. And you realize it is about meritocracy, about working together. All right. So let's move on to our last topic here. Elon Musk, the America Party, and political disruption. I've got a bunch of topics here that we can talk about. I just want to give some numbers here on this. And my take is different. Conservatives and Republicans are running scared. He's going to fracture the Republican Party. And my take is the exact opposite, and it's twofold. One, it's not going to happen because the CNN poll by the great Harry Enten, I don't know if you guys are familiar. He's a very excitable guy who does the polls on CNN. He says there's just 4% of Americans favor Elon Musk. 60% view him unfavorably. And so he is the face of the America Party. And it was launched to counter Trump's big, beautiful bill. But the reality check is third parties. And Big John, if you want to chime in and if you want to come on board for this topic, that's fine. The reality check is third parties have only won 0.2% of races since 1970. That's 24 races they won at over 13,000. So I want to give credit to Harry Enten. And then Mark Halperin had, and this was via Megyn Kelly. He's part of her network. Mark Halperin is an esteemed analyst, I guess, well-respected. And he said the four things for a third party to have success is money. He has it. Popular leader. He is not. Strong issue agenda. He doesn't really have an agenda outside the, we're going to release the Epstein list right now. And then skilled operatives. And by skilled operatives, Elon's not on any ticket. So he's got to find candidates to run, you know. So there's so many drawbacks. Gee, your thoughts, and then we'll go to Big John, and then we'll get Kent's thoughts on that. What do you think of this, Gee?
Well, I think Elon is doing what he feels is right at this moment. But people didn't vote for Trump or join MAGA because of Elon Musk. Elon joined, I want to say, around August of last year. So you're talking –
it was after the assassination is when he formally
came. Okay, yeah. So let's say July, right? You're talking 9 years, 9 years after Trump ran for president the first time, right? So he finally joins a bandwagon, and now he brought in all these people. No, I think – look, Elon's upset about this. I'm upset about it too. I think we should have cut more spending than we have and, you know, help narrow the deficit. I agree with Elon with that in that respect, but there's another way to lower the deficit is by growing the economy, which I think the big beautiful bill will do. But I agree with him. There's a bunch of junk in there, pork and junk, that was brought on by Republicans to satisfy their own races in the future. So I get what Elon's feeling, but you know what? I mean, this third party is nonsense. Is not going to do anything, and. Yeah, I say that right. As a libertarian joins the podcast.
So real quick.
But just real quick, like, if you think of the last president who won as a third party candidate, I mean, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but can someone throw out a name?
Because it was 1860, but I forgot his name.
Abraham Lincoln.
That's right, Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. The Whig Party had the Republicans had separated from the Whig Party, right. And they had a big issue agenda and slavery.
That's right.
So real quick on your thing, it's a reconciliation bill. I did a whole podcast on it. I completely agree with you. There's a lot of stuff. The biggest example is the salt tax, meaning it went from 10,000 to 40,000. Now put that in all these blue states. That's hundreds of millions of dollars. So yes, there was a lot of pork in there, but I will say this, that's not on Trump. That's Congress negotiating. Right. And that's and I wouldn't put that on Obama, on Biden, on anybody. That's Congress and these guys looking for reelection. John, your initial thoughts here on Elon Musk and the third party.
Yeah, so I don't think anybody thinks he's going to win anything with the America Party. But what it does is And I've always said, look, and I think you guys have to give me credit. I predicted Elon and Trump would split. I gave them till October, and I was wrong.
John, I will give you credit. John did say that. I actually even tweeted out some kudos. Because I thought it would take a couple years, and it took a couple months.
Because you know, what people don't realize is Elon's an engineer. So to him, there's no politics. There's solutions to problems, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, you mentioned it took him 9 years. I agree with you. It's because up until a certain point, he thought Democrats offered him a solution. Now, for whatever was bothering him at that moment, Trump was that solution. But more importantly, there's two things. One is, does he convert the America Party or does he leave it as a symbolic thing? But is it more of a PAC type of situation where he's going to start funneling money to key races? I think that's more of a danger. Remember, the Senate, a lot of stuff, The few pieces of legislation that have passed, a lot of them has come down to Vance having to break a tie.
Okay, right. Let me stop you there to ask you a question. So this is why I wanted Big John to come in. This is the bane of libertarians. It's Big John is absolutely correct. You're looking at it. He needs at least 10 House seats. I researched this. He needs – it's not three or four like people are saying. He needs at least 10 House seats and at least three senators. But – he can't get people in those races unless he can get the American Party on what, Big John? Fill us in on what the hazards of the
it's ballot access, right? So I've said this. In some states, it's easier to get to an opposition party to Putin than it is to get a third party in some states in the U.S., and that's not an exaggeration. My home state of New York, libertarians have won ballot access 3-4 times. Every time they win, midnight massacres on Friday, they upped the limits again. So now I think it's something ridiculous, like 60,000 signatures within a 2-month period, you know, whatever it is, right? So we see that issue here. So will he be able to get enough ballot access? That's a different question. Will he partner with the Libertarian Party? Now, he's not a Libertarian by any stretch of the imagination, but if the right circumstances align, will he be able to leverage the Libertarian Party's ballot access? Because that's the one asset the Libertarian
Party. Hold on, Big John, is that a hope, or have you heard any talk that they're talking?
I think it's been tossed around. Like if you talk to most Libertarians, they'll tell you he's not a Libertarian. He may align on the budget deficit, for example, but that's about it. A lot of the other things, he's really not Libertarian. He's anti-immigrant, which is not a Libertarian position. He's pro subsidy in a lot of cases, which is
healthcare.
Those are not Libertarian positions, right, typically speaking. So, right. I don't think he'll line up, but I do think, if he's smart, he's going to quickly pivot to saying, I'm going to throw money in some races. And the first Republican who says that either they're joining the American Party or they're willing to sign my, quote, Elon pledge. I'm making it up, right? The equivalent of the Liberty pledge or something like that. I'm going to throw my support behind them financially, and I'm going to campaign for them, and I'm going to make sure the X algorithms work in their favor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That, to me, is a more plausible response.
He's not gone down that road yet. Real quick, I apologize. Yeah. I don't want to keep Ken in
the
lurch
informed.
So real quick, Ken, let me add a caveat here because you're a businessman, even though you're a lawyer. You represented clients of business and all that. Now, there's already pushback from his company, specifically Tesla. But then you have SpaceX, you know, his AI company. They want somebody who's focused on their companies, not on politics. So what's your take? But how does the business side play into it as well?
Well, I'm going to challenge y'all to look at this from just a business perspective. When the assassination attempt happened, I would say Elon Musk realized Trump was going to win. And he had a tax credit for Tesla cars.
Oh, yeah.
And so he decided to get involved. This is my speculation. And he decided to spend a shitload of money to support Trump, to try to get him off of his, which he's always said, he's getting rid of the EV tax credit. The blow up that we're talking about happened when suddenly the big, beautiful bill looked like it was going to pass, and it got into the process and it was getting rid of the EV tax credit. So I would say all of this, from the tantrums to the, we're not cutting enough spending, was all because of an attempt to kill or cut the EV tax credit. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but it just all fits. And this new party he's talking about, he can't be the candidate for president because he's naturalized, so he's not eligible. So he can't be the presidential candidate. So so he can't bring in the part, you know, all the votes for Elon. And he says he's going to focus on House and Senate races. And that goes right back to, you want me off your back? Give me back my tax credit for my EVs. And he can throw a lot of money at it. But if he wants to make a difference, he would do for the conservative side what Soros has done and set up a series of groups that, you know, they are back to Elon, but they're so sophisticated. He's not sophisticated. He's an engineer. And so his attempts to help and influence elections have been naive, and they've come across naive. And so I think that all of his actions are to try to save the EV tax credit because he knows that that will kill Tesla over time. And everything from that, I think you can explain what he's doing based upon that. I think bit of it is that.
And there's a couple of billionaires that have this show called All Things In, a brilliant show. You guys should watch it. It's the number one ranked podcast in the world. We're catching up. You know? But they sat there and said, it is about that. It's because of Tesla. And they're like, don't fool yourself. It's not about Tesla and cars or batteries. It's about Tesla as an energy company and their expansion and the EV, the cars and all that. That's the first step. And sources out of the White House said that, yes, he was fighting to keep those EV, despite what he says publicly, I don't care about it. And I'm sure when he said that, every board member was calling them up. What the hell are you saying here? But I see your point. Now let's get to these few House races real quick to get your comments on it. We'll start with you, G. Again, I crunched numbers. I had AI help me. I read some articles, used my Excel spreadsheets. And even a race that's a Senate race, I found out some of them are only 7-10 million, but those are uncontested Senate races. Once a Senate race is contested, you exponentially jump to a couple hundred million dollars. Now, you talk 3 Senate races, and then you talk 10 House seats, at a minimum are a couple million in contested. They can even go up more. And then you're talking about setting up the machine, getting ballot access, fighting the Republicans and Democrat legislatures and courts. He's looking at probably $1 billion, which he can afford, but that's a lot of moving parts. So I think that in and of itself is it will make this more of a symbolic move. But my point is I don't even think it's a lot that he can sit there and win these limited races. It sounds good on paper, but the reality is much different, especially in politics. That is the dirtiest game in the world. Gee, your thoughts.
Well, last time I looked, we all have 24 hours in a day, and that includes Elon Musk, right? And so he has to run X. He just released Grok 4. He's running Tesla. He's trying to put the electrical infrastructure that Ken had mentioned earlier.
He's trying to get
us
to Mars.
And now he's going to devote a lot of time into this.
He's trying to get us to Mars.
Yeah, he's trying to get us to Mars and SpaceX. I forgot. I mean, that's a huge one as well. I think he needs to focus on those things. I think he's going to realize, I mean, this is a great idea and in the heat of the moment, right? Like when you argue with your wife, you say things and then a day later you're like, never mind. I just need to get to work and can go on about my day. I think that's what's going to happen with him. He's throwing this out there to scare people, but then this is going to take a lot of his time. And that's time that he can't devote to making electric cars, making electric infrastructure, making the AI that will probably think and do everything for us in the next few years and get us to Mars as well. He's got to determine, like, okay, is he going to win a handful of races that's going to do really nothing, or is he going to change the world as he thinks he's doing? And actually, I'll give him the props. He is changing the world through the technology. So I think it's a great thing in the heat of the moment for him to say, but I don't think it's going to have any lasting power, especially political history. I mean, political memory, I should say, only lasts about 2 to 3 months. I mean, what were we arguing about in May?
Exactly. I mean, yes.
People don't remember that.
Okay, John, Big John, let's go to the cleanest guy in the room. He's never done drugs, never done anything. Drugs take a toll on your body. he's on Ozempic or an Ozempic type drug, and we don't know what the fallout of that is going to be 10, 15 years ago. He's a self-admitted ketamine user because he suffers from depression. There are reports that he's done coke. I'm not trying to brand him as a druggie. Don't get that wrong. What I'm trying to say is the stress on everything he's doing now, politics is probably the most – I don't care how much he's built. Politics is a different demon, and it can quickly become the most stressful thing because you don't control 90% of politics, and his world is one of control. Big John, looking on the money for the races and adding in the physical toll this could take on him, your thoughts?
No, because I don't know whether you guys are going to want to hear this or not. He's a lot like Trump in the sense that Trump doesn't go by on much sleep. Trump really – I mean – unsubstantiated reports, but a lot of people say he's on something, whether it's Adderall or something else. That's been around since his days in New York.
I've never heard that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's been out there. Again, unsubstantiated, but you've been hearing it for so many years that, especially, like I said, back to his days in New York. But anyway, he personalizes issues, right? So Trump gets very nasty and personal, and he takes things personally. So does Elon Musk, right?
Okay, John, real quick, just for time's sake, though, real quick, I buy what you're saying, but here's the difference. Trump's companies aren't a trust. Elon's still running all these things. And as you says, he's a man's man in terms of how he's run so many multiple businesses, what he's done. But we're still talking. There's only 24 hours in a day, you know?
Well, I think he's looking at it in the scope as this
is just another job.
No, and I agree with you because I think that was one of the reasons I said he'd have his fallout. He has companies to run. He has boards to answer to, which we saw with Tesla. They threatened to kick him off the board. However, if he's personalized, because don't forget, when Trump threatened to strip his naturalizations, which it was ridiculous on Trump's part.
Yeah, well, I think he was joking too.
I don't think he was joking. I think people allow him to joke. I think he was looking into it because you had all his flunkies talking about it. So anyway, the point is, if it got personal, I could easily see Elon saying, okay, I don't need to run for president. Here's $2 or $3 billion, and this is what I want. I want 3 Senate races delivered to me. That's a couple of billion dollars.
I get that. Now, John's never done politics. G and I have on a lower level. But just throwing $3 billion, that money's going to disappear faster than you can say disappear.
Of course.
With a consultant class, with all this. Right. So, Ken, from you, and guys, we're at the 90-minute mark, so I don't want to keep this much longer. But, Ken, from your perspective, I noticed you have serious takes on Republicans and Democrats in terms of how you view them. What people don't realize is – Already, who's the ChatGPT guy? Sam Altman, a Democrat. Mark Cuban, Democrat. Yang's independent now, but a Democrat. Elon wants health care. You know, Elon's stance on Second Amendment, I researched it. He doesn't care for the assault weapon, which is a tool used by Democrats to literally take our guns. Elon is a Democrat at his core. I think, Ken, once the hoopla, the fear dies down, and let's say he does move forward, I think he's going to be attacked by both Republicans and Democrats. But at the end of the day, I think he has more potential to split Democrats who don't like the socialism stuff to go to his party. And he may get the fringe at a conservatives, but I think it's a Democrat party that has a chance to be fractured even more because they've gone all socialist. And the blue collar Democrat is truly their men and women lost, a Reagan Democrat, you know, the blue collar. What are your thoughts on that? Am I barking up because nobody's talking about that. So what are your thoughts?
Okay, when you have 3 candidates in a race from 3 different parties, the party that's going to win is the one that's the oddball out. So the 2 that are the most similar are going to split the votes. So if he recruits candidates that are conservative, then the conservative vote will be split and the Democrat will win. I think that he's dangerous because I think his goal is to win 10 House seats, 3 Senate seats, or just even half of that, because that's all it would take, or even cause the Democrats to win, and the Republicans will crater in giving back his EV tax credit again. I mean, I just think it's all about the tax credit. And if that's his goal, it's very reachable, very reachable. Anything else, I agree with everything you've said. I would point out that when you were talking about John, you were talking about how, when you were saying how clean and uncatamite, I thought you were talking about John, not Elon Musk. And I was like, wow, never done drugs, never drank. I was like, you're talking about me and John have a lot in common. I'm like, okay, oh, wait, he's talking about Elon. So yeah. Especially because you talked about how clean, I'm like, well, behind him, it looks really clean. And I'm like, yeah. So then I realized you were talking about Elon. So, but yeah. I think it's dangerous. I really do. I think that, but I think that he knows what he's doing. He studies something, and when he studies it, he goes right for it. I do agree that the third party is not going to be a threat on a presidential level because he can't be the candidate, but I don't think he wants to be a threat on a national level. I think he wants his tax credit back, and I think he will get it as soon as Trump's out of office.
Right. Let me toss something at you guys. I know it's not my show, but I have to ask this question. I apologize ahead of time, William. But
no worries, I just boot you off.
Fair enough. But Trump has proven, even and I'm someone who's not a Trump fan, but I have to admit to this, he's Teflon. A lot of this stuff that you would think that's happening now, the so-called division in MAGA, what's going on with the Epstein files that you guys have discussed, some of the immigration hiccups, a lot of that stuff slides right off of Trump. It's falling on other people in his orbit, right? So I've come to the conclusion he's finishing his term pretty much unscathed, right? But in his absence in 2028 and to a lesser extent in 2026, are a lot of your one-issue coalitions starting to crumble? In other words, Kennedy joined on the MAGA issue. He's sort of clowning things up in his position. Vivek.
I get you. I'll go first.
Same thing. I'm sorry. Same thing with Vivek. I mean, he disappeared more quietly, but he disappeared over the immigration issues. And now the blowout with Elon, more public, more personal, more visceral. So are you starting to see the fracturing of these one-issue coalitions?
Well, first of all, Vivek, I think, looks smart today, you know, where he may not have looked smart. I think history has shown great men. People don't talk about this. The Republican Party has become a big tent party ideologically, as well as we brought in more minorities than the party has ever seen in its history. We are truly, and this is what happens when you have various different ideologies and beliefs under one. So yes, when Trump leaves, it's going to be a scramble, and the person who will emerge will be the person who can keep, the most of those coalitions together. So, and it's way too early because, guys, a governor could come out. Somebody, Obama came out of nowhere. Trump came out of nowhere. It's a new era. So I think I get what you're saying, but I'm like, it's way too early to even consider that, you know, but you're right. I think it will split up. And the Republicans better find somebody who they think can bring it together. G, we're going to do a final round here. G, your final comments on Elon, the third party, and what John had to say. Then we'll go to Ken. Then we'll close the show out.
No, I mean, if you asked me 20 years ago, I think Rush Limbaugh was the one I heard him say first that the Democrats are one, you know, bunch of one issue voters, right? They got the one thing that they joined the Democrats for. I think now it's kind of flipped because now they're more ideologically aligned, right? You got to protect the trans, you got to protect the LGBTQ, you got to allow illegal immigrants and make them legal. And it's the Republicans who are now like, okay, well, I'm joining because of this one issue. And really Trump brought a lot of that out, right? So 20, 25 years ago, when it was said about the Democrats, that was viewed as a strength of theirs. Right. And then you look at maybe 8 years later, Obama came out of nowhere based on that. So I'm not sure that, you know, having coalition where the tacked on people are a bunch of one issue voters is a bad thing. But I think you're right, William, like it's going to be a populace that's going to come out of both parties in 2028 and try to scramble towards the center. I think I don't think the Gavin Newsoms of this are going to win the Democrat side of it. It might be Stephen A. Smith, who's coming out as the Trump on the left, right? So will Elon make a dent in 2026? I don't think so. I think people – I disagree with everyone. I mean, yeah, maybe just a handful of House races, but I think Trump will say, look, he just wants his hand out from the government, and that will be enough for people to go – yeah, forget you, Elon. You just want your $7,500 per car as a profit from us. And, you know, that can be negated pretty quickly. So that's my last word on that.
Ken, you get the last comments for the night. Your thoughts
well,
on Elon
and John? Well, I think the Republicans have a deep bench with the vice president and with the secretary of state, and then you go to the Florida governor. So they have a deep bench that are all very similar issues. I mean, there was a lot of people that would have voted for the Florida governor this time, except for they were like me. I was going to crawl over broken glass to vote for Trump because I agreed with him that he got robbed. And so I wanted him to have one more term. And so once that's completed, I'm open to anybody that has the same thoughts and same agreements. That the problem that's going to determine the election is going to be like when Clinton got elected. It's going to be things outside of the Republicans' control. If the economy goes down, then yes, the Democrats have a shot. Right now, the Democrats have to lose. They have to lose at least one more national election to force them to moderate, because right now they're setting for the only reason why we're losing is we're not liberal enough. We're not going far enough left. So they need to lose and lose big. I'll just take a loss, one more national election, and they will start to moderate. Our country needs that, and to be healthy. But the problem we've got is the Democrats on the far left are seeing that. They're seeing that that's where they're headed, and they're fighting that tooth and nail, and they don't want to go back to the time where Democrats were co-opting Republican issues to try to get elected, and they put up a moderate named Clinton. You know, there's already a civil war on the Democrat side. And I would say, you know, the Democrats have chased out everybody in their party that didn't agree with them when they decided, here's the issues, you have to agree with me. And I mean, that's what happened in Texas. Texas has always been a conservative state. Even when it was a Democrat state, it was a conservative state. And they've chased out the conservatives. Now they're chasing out moderates. They're fixing to only be room in their party for the far left. And when they do that, if they don't moderate, they will implode.
Right. You know, I was going to say you had the last comment, but I'm sorry, Ken. I got to ask you, your Senate race there with Cornyn and Paxton, and the wife came out today or this morning with a very stab in the back, you know, post, you know, to try to take her soon-to-be ex out. What do you think of that for the audience? It's a big race trying to get somebody who's considered by many as part of the swamp and Cornyn out with Paxton. What's your take on that, race, and how do you see that playing out?
Cornyn is considered the moderate, and Ken Paxton, who's the current attorney general, is running, and he's running as the true conservative. That race started out as at least 20 points in favor of Paxton. As the time has gone, it's gotten tighter. He's still up, but the problem is, like you said, his wife just announced yesterday that she filed for divorce. Her press release said she was filing for divorce on biblical reasons. The petition for divorce says that he's had an affair. It's adultery that's the reason why they're getting a divorce. She's a state senator. Yes. I mean, they had tried to impeach him and failed. And so I would say, even though the impeachment failed, it looks like they're going to be successful. I predict, and everybody that's predicted anything against Paxton has always been wrong, but I would say in a Republican primary, he just hit his high water mark because he's family and law and order, and he just had his family blown up, and his wife says they haven't lived together for a year. Right. So he hit his high water mark. He's going to probably start. He's going to get closer and closer. Then Cornyn gets in the lead, and then he goes to victory. The problem is, if Paxton were to win, then the Democrats would have a chance at winning the Senate seat in November, because Allred has just announced with that hope. He ran against Cruz 2 years ago, and it was a close race, probably with 5 or 6 points. Usually a statewide race in Texas is 13 points in favor of the Republican. So that's personalities. Paxton would make it even closer than that. So I think the Republicans are already circling the wagons around Cornyn. The national people are already endorsing him. Trump will probably stay quiet because he likes Paxton. But I, you know, never count Paxton out. But I think you're going to start primaries in March. Put your seatbelt on.
Yeah, that's why I asked. It's one of those critical races. So, first of all, Ken, thank you so much for coming on. We truly appreciate it. This is actually your third time on Grumblings Media, I believe. So we truly appreciate it. And to be honest, I'd like to have you back again, especially with legal issues. Big John, thanks for your 2 cents. And G, I hope you enjoyed the vacation. To everybody, look at that beautiful tan. and real quick, so the G, I agree, it's a one issue. And the Big John, I agree, it's a one issue. Ken, your point on Clinton is phenomenal. What I will add to that is Clinton was like Obama and Trump. He had that charisma. So I think the Democrats may struggle to find that moderate who has the charisma to sway because of how tribalistic that party has begun. And to everybody else, thank you for tuning in. Another great show. We always keep saying we're going to sit there and make them tighter, tighter, tighter. But we have so much stuff we talk about, and we hope you learn a lot from it. For myself, for G, John, and Ken, I am William Del Pilar. And until next week, we bid you adieu.